The girls are here.
Hi, I'm Jennifer. I'm an alcoholic. If you haven't... Hi, you guys. If you haven't been here before, my sobriety date is May 4th, 1991. My home group is God Calling. It's on Friday nights at 7 o'clock. We will be having a meeting on New Year's Eve tomorrow. So if you have nowhere to go and you want a lovely 11th step prayer and meditation meeting, please join us at Cranberry 9th and Cranberry at the Kingsley United Methodist Church. This microphone seems heavy tonight. So we all got through Christmas and here we are. We ended last week at the end of step 5. We reviewed the first 5 proposals, the first 5 steps, and we made sure that the work we had done was solid. And we ended up having done that thorough and fearless moral inventory with a list of our defects of character at the end of step 5, when we shared with God and another human being our inventory. I talked a lot about Terry last week. She's here this week. I don't know if I'll talk about her as much, but I'll talk to her, so that works too. So I ended up with that list, you know, after step 5, and I think we all do. And we talked about last week the 7 deadly sins. The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions book suggests we use those as a gauge of our character defects or shortcomings. They are pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. And I added, because I had more than that, selfishness, dishonesty, and judgmentalism. I did not have all of these character defects to the maximum. Probably didn't have many of them to the maximum. But I had more of them than I thought I had when I began step 4 and 5. The interesting thing to me to learn over the years is that all of these defects of character or shortcomings are a result of fear, of self-centered fear. And if I track back those behaviors, I will find the fear that underlies that character defect. So we came to step 6, where we were entirely ready. You know us, we don't do anything entirely. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. That, you know, seemed like a big order to me, because those defects of character, those coping mechanisms, that anger, you know, that procrastination, that judgmentalism in the form of gossip, those were things I did. Sarcasm made me, you thought I was witty, you know. Those were my strategies in dealing with people socially. And dealing with myself, you know, rationalization and things like that. I was a great rationalizer. That's why it took me 33 years to get here. So it's not as easy as it sounds to be willing to have them all removed, and that's what the step asks for. But it's not as bad as all that. And willingness, of course, is the key of this step. It is indispensable. And indispensable means we can't do it without it. We have to be willing to the step. So I looked at all of these, and you know, I sorted through them, and the ones that I really struggled with were selfishness. I was incredibly selfish. When I went through the 5th step, I really saw that. And I thought to myself, how can I really be rid of this? How can I let this go? Because if I don't take everything I want, how will I get what I need? You know, you can see the fear that lays under that. But I wanted to hang on to that. And then there was worry. Worry was, you know, that's... I was raised in a Sicilian, by a Sicilian mother, and worry was how you showed people that you loved them. You worried about them. You had fear for them. You didn't trust them with anybody. That was, and that was a sign of love. So I honestly, I didn't see how I could, like, I mean, that was my legacy, it was my heritage to worry, you know. Every woman in my family was a great worrier. And, you know, I remember visiting my grandmother. I think I told Terry this story years ago. Visiting my grandmother, my brother and I, some years ago, and getting to her door, and she opened the door and said, "I can't believe you're finally here. You never visit me." And we said, "But we are visiting you. Like, this is happening. This is..." That's kind of where we lived with, in this place where we were always concerned about what wasn't right and always searching for what was wrong. This was deeply embedded, so that was a tough one, worry. And then I started hearing in the rooms, if you pray, why worry? And if you worry, why pray? And I thought, oh, okay, that actually makes sense. I'm not sure I can do it. You know, that particular character defect is one that I still work on. Don't laugh. Do not nod. She's nodding because she knows. And that's okay, because what's relevant here in the step six is the willingness. And the book tells us on page 76 that if we cling to something that we don't think we can let go, we ask God to help us be willing. And that's what I did. That's the prayer of step six. So I said that prayer. But even when I became willing to this step with all my defects of character, I could not remove them. Self cannot overcome self. And I know this because I tried when I was drinking to be a wonderful person. I really did want to be a terrific person. And I wanted to not call my brother drunk at 3 o'clock in the morning and whine about our childhood and, you know, wake him up. And I wanted to not do those things. But I could not remove my own character defects. I hadn't even identified them at that point. But even now, at the beginning of step six, when I had them identified, I alone could not remove them. When I hear people say they're working on their character defects, I hope they're not working alone. Because alone, I cannot remove these. They will not change. The important thing too, and I didn't mention this, is and I've seen this happen in the room, so I'm going to talk about it a little bit, is at the top of step five, at the end of step five, when we have revealed these character defects to ourselves, they are fully operative. So... they are not gone because we know what they are. They are now a little more powerful than they ever were because we know what they are and we know how, and we can use them. So step six is for a step that has only one paragraph in the big book, and it's a short paragraph at that, is a vitally important step because it is the beginning of changing who we are. And so when I see people stop after step five, and I've seen them do that, I know what's going to happen because I know those character defects are in full, you know, they're full blown. We have to move through these steps. There's a reason they're in order, and there's a reason that they only give us an hour. Between five and six, you only do so much damage in that hour, and they keep us busy reviewing anyway. If you read in the big book, we get an hour to review what we've done. And then we move to step six, because otherwise, you know, we're just full-blown character defects running wild, you know. So God will do for me what I can't do for myself, and I can't remove my own defects of character. but I do have a part. And I did, you know, and I did try. I remember, I really did want to be a good person. I did try to do good things and caring things. It didn't seem to work well. I remember going for a walk with my mother when Ian was a baby. Most of you know Ian. So I was sober maybe, I don't know, he was like one or something. I was sober maybe 4 years. And we went for a walk, and my mother was just the sweetest woman. I mean, she worried a lot. She was Sicilian through and through. But she was the sweetest, kindest, most loving woman, and always was, you know, complimentary and caring. And we were walking, and I said, we were talking a little about sobriety and things, and I said, you know, Mom, I always wanted to be a good person. And she said, yeah, I know you did. And I thought, wow, I really missed the mark on that, didn't I? Like, I thought I was kind of, you know, sneaking it by, but no, my mom knew. So I have to do my part. God will do what I can't do, but I have to do what I can. And the only way to break a habit, Kevin was talking about this ahead of the step last week, but it's okay, we can talk about it again this week. The only way to break a habit is to practice the opposite of that habit. So, you know, I was judgmental, and I was. I need to practice tolerance, and that I can do. That I can do. You know, God will remove the rest, because
we go here.
Honestly, I have visual aids. Terry knows. I don't know if this is going to stay up, Jack. I think it's going to fall down. Hey, let me try that. There we go. Okay, thank you. At step 7, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Now see, character defects and shortcomings, Bill just likes to, he was a wordsmith, and he liked to use different words, but he meant the same thing. So when I arrived at the highest degree of willingness I was capable of at that time, I said this prayer. And this is the 7-step prayer. And in my home group, and I think I told you when we were on step 3, we say the 3rd step prayer. We meditate for 10 minutes. And then we say the 7-step prayer, and it goes like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. And we have completed step 7. Sounds simple, huh? Mm-hmm. So for me, and again, the great irony is in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the shortest amount of text of all the steps is given to steps 6 and 7. And they are, for me, probably were the most powerful and important steps, possibly with the exception of 11 and 12. And 1, of course, which, you know, got me here. But for me, this is where the psychic change began to happen. The willingness to change, you know, in step 6, am I willing? And asking for a higher power to help me to change. Which, Jack, the visual aid just like flew across the, but you had to be here to see it fly. Anyway. So I began to practice these things you guys talked about in the meetings the best I could. Honesty, unselfishness, acceptance, and love. And gradually, over the last 30 years, I have become a different person. I am not the person that I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's a really good thing. In fact, that's the most important thing, because the person I was drank. And the person I was will drink again. So I need to change. And in this step, I started to feel the change happening in me. I have become a person that I like, a person that cares about other people, that truly loves other people, that is so grateful for everything. I have found qualities that I did not have, like courage, empathy, tolerance, some patience, some quickly, some slowly come to us. But it's not an easy journey, though, because as our lives change and different situations come up, because, you know, when I came in here and I first did this step, I had no children. Sicilian woman with no children. Then I became a mother. Then the worry thing got, whoa. That's when it really got tough. I would say that little prayer. If you pray, why worry? If you worry, why pray? Because we have to work every day and an ongoing inventory of these character defects. And the book suggests that over and over and over again. You know, this is an ongoing program. I have to look at what's driving my behavior every day. And I've come to know that there are really only two motives. Love and fear. And if I can stop before I take an action or say a thing and pray about it and know what is driving that action or those words and ask, what would love do now? Then I am much less likely to act out of fear. And if I don't act out of fear, I'm less likely to fall back into these old, you know, kind of hurtful ways. Hurt me, that hurt you. We have, you know, some steps that are coming up that are going to help us to do this, you know, to stay on track. You know, these steps are, you know, in order for a reason. I'm really great. I really love step 7, 6, and 7. They changed me. And that's all I have. But now we do questions.
There we go.
Got the microphone.
Thanks, Jennifer. Now we turn it over to questions. Does anybody in the room have a question for Jennifer? I'll get there.
You had said, I do. I love that 7-step prayer, and I used to say it so much more as part of my meditation too. And I'm. It's beautiful to hear you say it. That was a real gift because it reminded me of what a magnificent prayer that is. You said in your remarks that when you hear someone talking about step 6 and how they were working on step 6, your hope is that they are not alone in doing it. And of course we have to pray to God to ask for the peace of mind and the quiet to understand where our true shortcomings are. But who else? I mean, how else? You mentioned using the thought of the opposite action as a new habit. Well, could you talk about that a little more, maybe some other practical things that you do in order to really address step 6?
Oh, you couldn't hear her? They can't.
Nothing.
Oh, they can't hear. They didn't hear.
No, can you ask them if they can use their outside voices, please?
Outside voices, please. Lynn asked if we could talk about other strategies, more practical strategies, to change the character defect, the parts that we can do into an asset. Wow, you know, that's a really good question. I really have to think about that. I'm going to have to go back a little ways. I think I just observed my own behavior a lot. I took daily inventories. I would see what I was doing. I would watch my behavior and my choices, and I would check my motives, or Terry would check them for me. We checked each other's motives back in the beginning, and that helped. That helped a lot. But it's as simple as honesty. You know, honesty comes in degrees. I was only able to be so honest when I came in. You know, mercifully, the Creator kept certain, things that I had done and people that I had hurt from me until I was able to psychologically, emotionally handle those. But cash register honesty, I could do that. I could not steal anymore from people I worked for. That was a big one. That was way better than stealing from the people I worked for. So it is eminently practical now that you mention it. It really is like flipping over the character defect. Rather than being judgmental, being tolerant. And taking the action on that. Like literally becoming involved in communities that I may have been judgmental about prior to that. So it is maybe following it up, following that change up with a life change, a lifestyle change maybe, even. Anger is another one. I had to learn a little bit about anger because it's human to get angry. It is not human to hold on to anger. It's not healthy to hold on to anger and use it as a weapon. I had to learn to express my feelings, including anger, in a calm and rational way, to realize that some of my anger was relevant to the moment and some of my anger was connected to the past when it was out of proportion to the situation. I needed to do more work. That's a big one, and I see it a lot with women I work with. I remember a situation when I was working at Stairway Center for Art and Culture. There was a situation with one of the women I worked with, and it really made me angry. She interfered in a project we were doing, and it caused some distress for some of the clients. And I was able to say to her, "This made me angry. What can we do differently? How can we change this?" And then I was able to let it go. I didn't hold on to it. She's still my friend today. So resentment started to slip away, that character defect. I stopped holding on to anger. Fear has always been, the heart of every character defect for me. And so I work on fear most. I pray specifically the seven-step prayer with fear, because that's always, that's at the root of my illness. Self-centered fear. That's an alcoholic. Does that help?
I think Jim on Zoom had a question.
Yeah, Jim had a question. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Jim. I'm from Baltimore.
Hi,
Jim. Thank you so much again for tonight. And my question, you mentioned several times tonight, if you pray, why worry? If you worry, why pray? I think that's it.
That is.
And I pray.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes worry about the very thing that I pray for.
Mm-hmm.
So I know there's a lot of things you just can't take literally in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I have my thoughts on what you just said, which I think are positive, but mine don't matter right now. Your thoughts on that, like maybe to give me a little different direction on how to look at that. If you pray, why worry? And if you worry, why pray?
Thanks. That's a good question.
Jeff, can you repeat that just so?
Oh, okay, yeah. All right, there we go. Jim said, if you pray, why worry? And if you worry, why pray? Is something he's heard too. but it hasn't worked quite as positively for him as it sounds like it has worked for me. Am I getting this right, Jim? Kind of? Yeah, me, yeah.
And it could be something like one of my daughters is going to travel.
Yep.
That's what I pray for, safe travel.
Right.
But they're going to be driving, and you know what, I know there's maybe going to be some unpleasant weather conditions. So, you know, I think in the back of my head, I worry like a dad that I'm going to be safe.
Yeah.
So that's where the, you know, if you worry, why pray?
I understand exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, when my son flew to Europe, yeah, can I tell you about how many times I prayed for remove the fear and then, you know, prayed. And that didn't mean that, you know, I wasn't a little concerned for the 8 hours he was over the Atlantic Ocean. Because I was. But for me, that was important because I was raised in a culture that defined worry, equated worry with love, made worry into a positive thing. If you did not worry, you must not care. And, you know, it really was exhausting, you know, to have to worry about all these people. And as I cared about more people, then more worry. So it was changing that interpretation of what worry was. And realizing that it wasn't really healthy. It is going to happen. It does happen. It still happens. It probably always will, as long as I'm a parent and a wife and a friend. It's going to come up from time to time. Definitely is. I have tools today that I use, and they get me, you know, they get me through. But I don't use worry as a way of life anymore. And I don't see it as a positive attribute or as a way of showing love. You know, I realize that all that worrying sometimes shows a lack of trust in God and in the person I'm worrying about. Sometimes it's not about that. When my husband goes on his motorcycle trips, I don't even want to talk to you about that because, you know, I just can't help it. And it's not about me thinking he's not qualified to do what he's doing, but you know, there's all these people with pickup trucks and, you know, between here and wherever he's going. So I do a lot of praying then too. So I just use the tools and I worry less than I did, and I see worry in a whole different way. Does that help?
Thank you.
Sure.
Anybody else in the room? I knew Brenda was good for one. She's got a couple, I bet. No. Not just one.
I have to fill up Kevin's time. Thank you, Jennifer. So I have, this might be an odd question, but I'm looking at how the words of the steps are so profound. Like, we don't say, we asked him, humbly asked him is huge, because we can't go there with an ego.
Right.
So do you find when you're sponsoring people that are going through, let's say, something that they think is like, oh my God, traumatic, trying to resolve something, do you find it easier to immediately see what's going on with them to try to maybe, I'll use the word fix, I don't mean fix, but help them, more so than when you yourself is in the same situation to fix that problem? Because I can see another something that I can't see in me sometimes. And it's easier to see a picture of something and what's wrong rather than look in the mirror and see what's wrong. Do you find that?
What I usually find is that when somebody I'm sponsoring is going through a trauma or issues, I'm learning about me at the same time that I'm helping them. I'm using whatever tool. I don't want to be too specific because, you know, they might hear this one day, and I don't want to. But if they're going through some concern, maybe about, say, their marriage, I'm just going to, you know, hypothetical here, and certain behaviors, I can use that what they're going through as I'm guiding them to find what's driving their feelings and what they can do about it to help me to look at my life and say, okay, well, do I have things here that I need to look at too, that I can use these same strategies and tools? Yeah.
Sure, thanks.
Anybody else on Zoom?
Yep,
Terry has a question.
Surprise! Okay. One of the things that made me so scared in my early recovery was I would hear people say fear and faith can't live in the same body. And that really bothered me because I knew that I had faith. I mean, it wasn't a lot of faith, but it was a little bit. And so I was convinced that I was doing something wrong because I was still afraid. What the book says, however, and I always get it backwards, it says all men of faith have courage, or all men of courage have faith. I don't remember which way it goes. I was looking. And so that's what I know, you know, to be true for me, is that I can pray and I can still be worried, but I have the courage to walk through that I didn't have before.
Can you hear
me? And so when you're working with someone, like, how do you get that point across to them that it's okay that you're human, that you're going to worry, that you're going to be afraid, but it's okay?
That's a great question, and fear and faith can't live in the same body is nowhere in the big book at all. I couldn't completely eliminate fear. I still can't. It still pops up. I think it's all men of faith have courage. They trust their God. And over the last 30 years, I've walked through a lot of situations where fear was involved, you know, medical situations, people that we care about losing, parents, you know. And the courage is in showing up anyway. The courage is in being the best daughter, wife, friend, sister in that situation I can be, even if I have some fear. Taking the best care of myself that I can do, even if I have some fear. That's how I guide the people the women that I sponsor, is in the same way. I never use that phrase, you know, fear and faith. You know, I don't know what it was. Faith, fear knocked on the door, and faith answered, and nobody was home, or something like that. Not in the big book. Not in the 12 and 12. We're human, you know. We're going to get angry once in a while. We're going to have fear once in a while. We're going to be envious once in a while. These things will come up. It's using the tools, you know, and the progress that we've made. I'm not going to be perfect. I'm not supposed to be perfect. If I'm perfect, I can't understand you. And if I can't understand you, I can't help you. So what am I doing here? You know, if I can't help you, that's what I'm here for. So we don't get perfect, and fear is not totally eliminated, but courage is the flip side of that coin, and gratitude is too. I've noticed when I'm grateful, I'm much less fearful. I had a sponsor, Abby. I've had four sponsors over the years, but Abby used to say, if you're not grateful for what you've got, don't you dare ask God for anything else. And I mean, she was pretty clear on that. But it's true, because it really all starts with gratitude. I don't know, Terry, is that good? Yeah.
Kevin, anybody else in there? Oh, Jack's got something.
Thanks, Jennifer. I remember hearing a speaker once talk about the seven-step prayer, and he pointed out that it talks about usefulness to God and to my fellows, but it doesn't say anything about me. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that, whether there's any significance to that part of the prayer.
Um, Yeah, I sometimes add that in when I say that prayer, actually, to be honest with you. Yeah, I noticed it too. That seems kind of a mess, but, you know, depending on where I'm at. My prayer usually is God, I can only carry what's mine today. And I can only do that with your help. So please, you know, all these others that I am concerned about, please carry them. That's my prayer when I am weighed down, maybe. Lynn.
Lynn McBrayer. I don't mean to add to your lead by any means, Jennifer, but I just remember when I would do that seven-step prayer, and this kind of goes to Jack's question. I remember, especially doing it after meditation, how that seven-step prayer would make me feel light and ready to receive. And because of the fact that I was not a part of that equation, that the whole focus was to prepare myself for my God and to be of service to others, it just opened me up. And that was the thing that I loved about that prayer. It made me light and it made me open.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, the prayer that I say, you know, that I can only carry what's mine and I can only carry it with God's help, is the same type of prayer. Because then I am lighter. And when I'm lighter, I can be more helpful. Usually, I say that prayer if I'm carrying something that isn't mine and I shouldn't be carrying it. My sponsor says if you're doing more for someone else's recovery than they are, you have crossed a line.
Anybody else? Zoom, last call, Zoom. Oh, Kevin, you ready? Huh?
Kevin doesn't like the meeting to end early.
Goodness. Anyway, thank you again for coming and doing this. You did a great job, as always. I really appreciate it. You're talking about worry and prayer and fear and love, and you've explained how it's kind of a process, but one of the things that I'd like you to try to expound on is, you know, your love and your fear thing. Mm-hmm. When did it kind of, you know, you catch yourself earlier and earlier and earlier in those shortcomings, character defects, but when did you start feeling that transition within you where it went, where the fear part was diminished and the love part was increased and the worry was decreased and the prayer was, you know, when you reach for fear first, and then when did you reach for prayer first? When did you reach for love first versus, you know, fear?
Well, I started reaching for prayer first pretty early in my recovery. And that, you know, leads to choosing love. I think when I saw myself being able to show up for people in a way that I had never wanted to or done before, when I saw myself, you know, being able to pick up the phone and call my father rather than, you know, complain about him not calling me, when I saw my behavior change, you know, I showed up to my life.
How long did that take? I mean, it's evolving, I understand. But
not really, probably after the first year. It started, yeah. It started changing after the step, you know, after the steps. That's...
And when did that balance, that teeter-totter thing of reaching for fear, reaching, realizing love, however you know, accept that, where it's, mm-hmm. you know, you're not doing it yourself, you have, oh yeah, it's God and I, mm-hmm. not me and God, you know, it goes me and God, God and me. When did that kind of...
I think I started really knowing that there were only two choices of motives. Probably some years in, like maybe five, six years in. And I started seeing that when I allowed a character defect to become operative again, which some we sometimes do, it was like a Pandora's box. You know, it was just going to be, you know, if I didn't use that 10th step, which we will get to, and deal with it, we were going to open up the whole Pandora's box and they were all going to come running out. And fear was always connected. You know, I sponsor women who will tell you that when they call me up and they say things like, my boyfriend did this and, you know, I'm so angry at him and, you know, he's going to go here for the weekend with so-and-so, I will ask them, what is the fear? Because that's what's usually driving, you know, that angry attitude or in me, in them. So I started seeing that in me, and I think, you know, pretty early, you know, that fear was a driver. I remember being, like, I was a writer by trade for some time, and I remember being a kid and writing a story, a fictional story, about my childhood, and the first line in it was, fear had his seat at our dinner table. So that's how ingrained fear was. So I do pay attention to that, you know, to what's driving my behavior and my actions.
And so how does love today, because, you know, you've got some time and you've worked through a lot of different things, how does love accentuate itself, or at least have that as a tool in that toolbox that we have for like 6 and 7?
Well, I ask myself, what would love do here? You know, what's the loving thing? Sometimes I don't have to ask myself. Sometimes, you know, it's been a while that I've been practicing. You know, my husband says I never got good at anything I didn't practice. But I've been practicing, you know, these principles for a while. And so I don't always have to examine my motives. You know, love is pretty... is in the forefront of my life a lot of the time. But when I do have to stand back, I really say, what would love do now? What's the loving thing here? You know, is the loving thing to sponsor somebody who won't call me? Or is the loving thing to let them go and find somebody who they're more comfortable with? What would love do here? And I also seek counsel, because I have a very good sponsor and co-sponsor.
You know, that's kind of what I was driving at, is that, you know, with time, this, wherever you are in your program, that you can evolve to this kind of situation where, you know, at the beginning, if somebody told you what you were saying, how you feel today, and how you deal with worry, and how you deal with fear, and how you deal with love, and how you deal with these things. If they told you that when you had 6 months or a year and a half, you'd just go,
who's that?
Yeah, never. Might be for you, but not for me.
Right.
But one of the things that, being a long timer, you're able to at least emulate, not only emulate that behavior, but put it out there so people can say, yeah, I guess that's possible.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And I think that's true for all of us.
Okay, last call. Anybody else? Zoom people? Nope. All right. Thanks, Jennifer.